On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, there is a lot to go over. We talk about the Schlitz show in New York, review that, and the three other wild card series that are all officially over. And we look ahead to the NLDS and the ALDS. This is like the best time of the baseball season. If you're listening to this, you know that. So I will shut up so that you can listen to me talk for the next hour and 15 minutes. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that will never get sick of Schlitz puns. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And boy, did we witness a Schlitz show last night in the Bronx.
Yeah, I mean, if we thought we were approaching anywhere resembling a stop to the puns you just referred to, No. We are just getting started. Hi, Jake Mintz. It's so good to see you. It's Friday morning. We're recording a podcast. I haven't been this excited to record a podcast in a while. When we only go twice a week, we got that itch to get back behind these microphones and start yapping. And you just teased it. We have a lot to talk about, but it is quite obvious where we need to begin. And that is our opener.
Did the Yankees schlit themselves or did the Red Sox get schlat? Either way, rookie right-hander Cam Schlitler was brilliant last night in the Bronx in Game 3 of the AL Wildcard Series between the Yankees and the Red Sox. Schlitler, who debuted in June, I believe, started the year in AA, made some starts in AAA, 24 years old, last night in his first career playoff start. He goes 8 scoreless, masterful innings, allowing just 5 hits to the Red Sox, walking 1 batter, walking 0 batters, punching out 12, and getting the win. He hands the ball over to David Bednar for the 9th. The Yankees win that one 4-0 to eliminate the Red Sox and move on to the American League Division Series against the Toronto Blue Jays. But the story of this one was not how the Yankees scored, but rather how the Red Sox did not.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to kind of work backwards. We're going to recap the wild card series and then preview who these teams will advance to face. But it's amazing that we are not starting this conversation, regardless of how this series went, with Garrett Crochet. But we got to start with Cam Schlitler, because this was very simply one of the greatest postseason pitching performances of all time, regardless of the context that you just laid out, which is that he is a rookie, which is that he wasn't really a top prospect until, I mean, really ever. But, you know, I think that some people in the know who follow the Yankee system closely had a sense that something like this, in terms of him being a really good major league starter right away, was possible. We saw glimpses of it in the regular season, but this was just, I mean, in a winner-take-all game against the Red Sox, it was amazing. I mean, it was, and by the way, the type of dominance that it was, and we can get into kind of the themes of this week in general, which is just fastball velocity, a lot of great stats coming out about that. The way that he dominated was with heaters. I mean, we know that he throws hard. There are a lot of guys that throw hard, but, you know, we'll talk about Tarek Skubal a little bit later and Crochet. Those guys throw really hard, and they also have like multiple 70 or 80 grade off-speed pitches. Schlitler was just going up there throwing cheese, both the fastball, both the four-seam and the two-seam. I think all of his swings and misses were on the fastball, and that is what dominance is all about. And that was an unbelievable showing,
especially in the context of fastball usage being at an all-time low in baseball. Mm-hmm. If you look at how guys are dominating now, having an effective fastball is obviously the base to any strong profile as a pitcher, but we're seeing less and less of that. And for Schlitler to go out there and be like, I throw fastball now, good luck, was really remarkable. And for a kid who, I think we should just do the Cam Schlitler story here. So he's from the Boston area, from Walpole, Mass., which is like 15 minutes from Foxborough and like 40 minutes from Fenway, I believe. Like, there is someone in Cam Schlitler's life who, I don't know if he's married, was at or will be at Cam Schlitler's wedding, who has a Red Sox tattoo. Like, I feel pretty strongly about that, right?
Yeah.
And for him, so he grows up a Red Sox fan. He's at the parade in 2004 as a three-year-old. He goes to Northeastern in Boston, and in his second career college outing, faces the Red Sox in the scrimmage they have with Northeastern in spring training. He starts that game. He works one inning. He faces Jaron Duran. And at that point, did nobody think that they would face again Jaron Duran and Cam Schlittler? And yet they did.
Yeah, and so I'm glad you give the kind of personal biographical context, because that is the easiest part of the story that is just amazing. And not that we haven't had Yankees Red Sox crossover already. I mean, Ben Rice has a similar thing that we've already kind of been talking about recently. But I kind of want to talk about Cam Schlittler, the pitcher, too, because I think for the people that were introduced to him last night or have started to learn who he is over the past few months, and be like, well, where did this guy come from? He wasn't a high pick. And like, how is this 6'6 dude throwing 100? Like, what do you mean he was, what was he in college? This is a great example of, you know, the Yankees in particular, what they prioritize really on both sides of the ball, which is big dudes that they think can throw hard. And that is true in the international market. That is true in the draft, whether it's in the first round, whether it's in the seventh round. We know that teams, not just the Yankees, to be clear, are capable of developing velocity with the right kinds of athletes. And what you have with Schlittler is really a best case scenario of someone who was not throwing that hard in college. I think like up to what, 93, 94, sitting 91, 92. And he had good stats in college, right?
Yeah. I was talking to a good buddy of ours who is a pitching coach in the Yankee system. And he was saying that on the complex, Schlittler was like 89 to 90 when he showed up after the draft. Like, he would touch higher, but in terms of like where he was sitting, like that's where he was at. And I talked to Matt Blake, who's the Yankees pitching coach, last night after the game. And he was like, yeah, like with a kid like that in the seventh round, you see a big body who you think can add strength and some mobility, where you think there's developmental meat on the bone, and you put him into what you think is the best pitching development apparatus in the sport, and you let it cook. And Schlittler, like, when you say was on some people's radars, he was on people's radars entering this year. I believe Fangraphs had him ranked fifth in the Yankee system. Mm-hmm. He is not mentioned on their list heading into the 2024 season. And so that's really the key point for Schlittler. For 23 into 24, he adds strength, he adds velocity, he shows up in 24 and has a dominant minor league season. And the reason why it's not complicated, I mean, we saw it last night. That fastball gets hitters out. It is that simple. Yes. When you can lean on 98 to a hundo with that level of carry and from such a bizarre angle, because it's the almost like the Felix Bautista elevator shaft fastball, that type of thing always plays. And boy, did it play last night.
Yeah, I agree that in that sense, it's not complicated. But the other thing that is different and why his, you know, development is so impressive, and also why you target someone like that, is that he did have some feel for pitching. You know, the command was pretty good. Yeah. He had success in college. This is not just a big body that he say, oh, well, we can get this guy to throw 100. Because there's a lot of those guys in professional baseball now. You know, I mean, let's be honest. Teams like the Dodgers are churning them out all the time. Many of them are either not starters or are getting hurt. It's not just the part where it's like, oh, he's big, we can get him to throw hard. The Yankees have a bunch of those guys too that aren't necessarily good yet. But he seemingly has managed to combine the incredible physical development with an ability to pitch enough. And to your point, it's not like those off-speed stuff, those secondary pitches are that good right now. But when your two fastballs are that good, you're in pretty good shape. And I think that's the part I want to really hammer home, is it can't just be about the velocity, because there's a lot of guys throwing hard. Now, obviously, being able to hold this velocity into the seventh and eighth inning of a postseason game, that's a different level of special that we are now starting to understand with Schlittler. But I think that's the part that you have to give credit to him and credit to the Yankees, that is not just like, oh, he started throwing hard and now he's good. Sure. Clearly, he had something more than that.
Yes. I will say, though, my favorite moment of the postgame last night, and I put this in my story, I talked to Garrett Cole about Schlittler. And I was like, at what point this, like tonight, at what point did you realize that he could accomplish something like this? And Cole goes, 13 or 14 big league starts ago. He was like, I saw the gas. It's big gas. When a kid's got that type of gas, it makes everything else easier because you can make, you can live with your mistakes, right? Like, yes, hitters can hit velocity now, but it's also the angle and the carry on it. Mm-hmm. It's like that allows you, I'm young and I missed the fastball. I got too much of the zone. Oh, you know what? It was 99. And so you fouled it off, right? Like, you just have more leash. And there were moments like that last night. Anything else on Schlittler? I mean, again, no matter how you cut it, it was as remarkable as it gets. You know, I believe it was the first start ever, not even like for a rookie, like first start ever in the playoffs of 12 Ks, no runs, no walks, eight innings. Mm-hmm. You know, like we're not saying what a start for a rookie. Like this was an all-time great playoff start.
Yeah, but to your point, like we don't have to say for a rookie because, as you said, it was that good. But the fact that he's doing it as a rookie is cool. And as we think about the theme of this postseason, he was going up against another rookie in Connelly Early, who didn't throw that poorly. You could certainly argue that they left him out there for longer than expected. You know, we were wondering if we were going to see the Mets throwing a bunch of rookies if they made it to the postseason. This was a theme for over the second half of the season for a lot of teams, which is our teams, because of their pitching situations, just going to say, screw it. Let's just go with the talented youngster, even if he has nothing, no experience whatsoever. And for Schlittler, who, you know, had a reasonable sample of major league experience this season, you know, to Cole's point, yes, you can see it there, but you still don't really know what you're going to get when you throw him into a postseason winner take all game. But he showed up and it was a legendary showing and now makes him an absolute X factor for the Yankees moving forward. But before we get to the Yankees and Blue Jays, we kind of have to talk about the rest of the series and how we got here, because the fact that the Yankees were even in this situation was to even be in position to win, the first team ever to come back after losing the first game of a wild card series since 2022. It did happen a couple times in 2020. We're not counting that. Sorry. But for the last 3 years, teams were 0-15 in series, including this year, losing game one. But the Yankees, after Garrett Crochet absolutely dominated, I need you to talk about that here in a second, and then a really close, impressive win with an amazing Jazz Chisholm bout of base running on Wednesday, they came back and they got it done.
Yeah, so I was at all three of these. Game one was just all about Crochet. The Red Sox. So, I mean, Max Fried was incredible for the Yankees as well in that game. Crochet allows a solo homer to Anthony Volpe early, just kind of leaves it up and Volpe gets his hands to it. Volpe just as a character looks confident again. You could see it in his defensive footwork. You could see it in his at-bats. Like, he's not the best player in the world and he's not a future MVP shortstop anymore. But the talent's in there when he's not like freaking out and his baseball clock isn't all, you know, to the wind. So he takes Crochet deep. That's the only blemish. Crochet is incredible. Throws 117 pitches. Cora leans on him as he should. Red Sox score two, I believe in the seventh, off of the Yankees bullpen. It was Luke Weaver. There was a play where Aaron Judge couldn't really throw the baseball, where Trent Grisham should have cut him off. I think that is very relevant as we move forward. The way that the Red Sox talked publicly about running on Judge and testing Judge was so funny, where Alex Bregman was asked about it, and he was like, Judge is one of the best outfielders in baseball, and there are certain situations where we want to do certain things. And everyone's like, okay, cool. Like, you can't just say, that guy can't throw hard right now, so we're going to make him look like an idiot.
You could say that, but.
So the Red Sox win game one. Game two, the move that kind of changes the tenor of the series is Alex Cora pulling Brian Baio in the third inning with the score, I believe, tied at two at that point. Ben Rice hit an early home run. Red Sox pounced back. That leads to the bullpen carousel, which the Yankees win with the Austin Wells single down the line that scores Jazz Chisholm from first. Jazz moving on the pitch, 3-2 count. Flies around the bases, slides into home. Pandemonium. pandemonium at Yankee Stadium. And what happens with that move is its core clearly trying to win game two and not have to do a game three. And because he went to the bullpen early, I think it caused him to lean on Connolly early a little bit longer than he would have liked, than he should have, than he would have otherwise, right? I think if Bayo goes four in game two, we don't see the rookie kind of left out there to dry. In game one and half of game two, I felt like there was a path where Cora was just out managing Boone again. And that's not how it panned out. I think in the end, Cora loses the series like in the dugout as well. Look, no one was touching Schlittler anyway, but leaving early out there to dry for too long was kind of a big moment last night. Let's eulogize the Red Sox very briefly before we preview the DS. Weird year. Just such a weird year. In the end, so, I think there are two reasons why they did not win. One is injuries. Not having Lucas Giolito was a very important thing. Not having Roman Anthony was a very important thing. But at the end of the day, and this is the second point, I don't think this roster was ever good enough to win a World Series, especially because they did not make the necessary improvements at the trade deadline.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I would say, too, like, I mean, the Anthony injury was such a big deal because this lineup, since they traded Rafael Devers, which you can say was still a move that worked out because they played better after the fact and they cleared up some space for the roster to function better, this lineup felt a bat short from the moment they traded him and really felt two bats short as soon as Anthony was out. And so, and especially with Bregman, who was not nearly as good once he came back from his injury, Story's resurgence was incredibly encouraging. Amazing. And that's something that continues to complicate the roster, but also is at least, okay, he's a good baseball player. We're not as concerned about him. It's funny that Yoshida ends up being the one putting the best swings on in this, you know, over these last couple games. And, like, what is his future? And now you have a situation where there's still a lot of reasons to be really excited about the Red Sox moving forward because of the youth, because of Crochet. But boy, do we have some big, you know, decisions to make. Not quite in the same way as, I mean, it's kind of the same conversation that we're going to have about the Mets, except the Red Sox did not, you know, finish the season in embarrassing fashion. You did by some standards because you lost to the Yankees, but still you got into the playoffs, you played well, but then you had some bad luck and it is what it is. That said, like the Mets, and honestly even more than the Mets because of just the way the roster is constructed, you got some big decisions to make. Bregman is of course the headliner,
absolutely,
but this outfield is still a huge question mark moving forward in terms of who you're actually sticking with going forward. But I still think that there's reasons for excitement in Boston, but this was, and the defense, I mean, that's the other thing that really was just not pretty, was not pretty all year.
So,
and burned them a little bit in this game too. But you know, yeah, Red Sox, man,
how
what
many
a
guys
weird,
on
what
the
a
roster,
weird, weird season.
How many guys in this roster are not platoon players? Bregman, Trevor Story, and because of his defense, Sidon Rafaela. Like, I think that's it. Carlos Narvaez is good. He's an everyday catcher. But like the other five spots, and that includes Jaren Duran, awful series Duran. From him, right?
Yeah.
I just don't think if you're the Boston Red Sox and you have that kind of coin, or should, you should be entering a playoff series with five platoon players, right? We are not the Milwaukee Brewers here. And I think that is something that Alex Cora alluded to a couple times. And this is not to take anything away from Rob Refsteiner and Romy Gonzalez and whatever, but like, and you could win a World Series with a couple of platoon guys. It can't be the basis of your roster in that way. And I think there just was a talent gap here compared to the Yankees, which I talked about heading into the series and why I picked the Yankees to win the World Series. That is all. Goodbye to the Red Sox. Happy trails. Have a nice offseason. We now move to the ALDS, Yankees Blue Jays, which will begin Saturday evening in Canada at the Rogers Center under the dome. The two teams that tied for the lead in the American League East, the Blue Jays won the division based on their season series record against the Yankees. And I love when it lines up like this. We play 162. They're totally even for the sake of fairness and narrative, you know, justice, that these two teams get to battle it out over a five-game set one more time. We will know once and for all who the better team is. Heading into the series, I'm going to pick the Yankees because I think as currently constructed, health-wise, their roster is better than Toronto's.
Yeah, and you know, we can get into the pitching matchups and what we're thinking about here. But you mentioned that context, of course, of the teams tying. The Yankees took advantage of their easy schedule in September and made it interesting. And credit to Toronto for fending them off, because they also basically had to win almost every game over the last 10 days to ensure that they would at least remain tied and win that division. And they did that. Of course, the Blue Jays won this season series 8-5. Now, most notably, that includes a 6-1 record at home, including a memorable mop of the Yankees in early July when the Yankees were really kind of going through it. They played 7 of their games in the series in Toronto, 6 on the road. The Yankees did win both series, I believe, against Toronto at home. But this is part of why Toronto is here in the higher seed and with the bye, is because they were able to take care of New York in the middle of the season to that degree. That said, while the Yankees, we have seen plenty in October over the last half decade, have some big successes, some big failures, of course. The Blue Jays, who the fact that they are here, credit to them for what they have done this season, but it is hard not to think about how this has gone for them when they have been in the postseason recently, which is 3 straight trips to the playoffs, getting swept in 2 games in the wild card series. That's in 2020 against the Rays. That's in 2022 against the Mariners. That is in 2023 against the Twins. Now, only the Mariners was at home.
You know you have a bad run of show in the playoffs when you're the one who breaks the Twins playoff drought, right?
Dude. Right, exactly. And the Mariners, for that matter, right? Like, you're facing two teams that are known for losing in the playoffs or not being there at all. And that is how that went. They also, of course, lost Game 5 of the 2016 ALCS. So it is an L7 in October, dating back to 2016. The last time the Blue Jays won a playoff game, Aaron Sanchez got the start. So that is how long it has been. Shouts out to Aaron Sanchez, one of our favorites, but I don't know what he's up to now. I don't believe he will be pitching in this series for Toronto. That is for sure. So as for the pitching matchups, you know, Kevin Gausman for sure going game one. And that's significant because the Blue Jays started Gausman, I believe, on the final day of the season to essentially help ensure, now they ended up scoring a billion runs, but to help ensure that they would even get that top seed, which could have backfired horrifically had they lost and then had to go to the wild card series without him. But Gausman will be super rested. And do you have a sense for the first game for the Yankees? Because that one is going to be a question mark. Whereas once we get to Sunday, presumably we will see Max Fried, who started on Tuesday.
I think it's got to be Luis Gil. Maybe they piggyback him and Will Warren. I just think that Gil's stuff is going to play better. Because of what Schlittler did last night, the bullpen's going to be ready to roll. And so they don't need as much length. I think Warren gives you length. I think Gil gives you a better chance to dominate. So I think he'll go 3 or 4, and then they'll start the carousel, which will be interesting because the Yankees haven't really done it like that yet this postseason, right? They got 6+ from Fried, 6+ from Rodon, and 8. God, 8 from Schlittler. So I think it'll be Gausman warning game one, and then game two. Oh, Bieber Fried is sweet. That is going to be fascinating. I really think whoever wins that game wins the series. Then it will come back here to the Bronx. I'll be here for game 3. With Carlos Rodon against Trey Savage, which is just a delightful showdown of two North Carolina college, not graduates. And this is hilarious. It's the first time that these two teams have met in the postseason, which is always a fun thing.
Amazing fact. And you mentioned Savage. we're assuming he's starting that game. I don't know where Max Scherzer fits into this pitching plan. I know John Schneider, when asked about it, he was like, yes, Treya Savage will be a part of our preventing runs, I think was the quote. He was like, he wasn't like, he will start. He was like, he'll be a part of it.
Well, I hope so, if you're putting him on the roster.
Right, exactly. So we can assume he's Savage. And then now, again, 24 hours ago, this wouldn't have been something I was zeroing in on at the start of this conversation, but boy, does Cam Schlittler loom large in a game four as a potential showdown with Gossman or whatever. So
which
suddenly
is a
he's just like this
you
main
totally
character.
Thought
yeah.
You were going to say at some point this Yankee season. It's always funny, right? Aaron Boone talked about this. Like, he remembers Cam Schlittler coming to big league camp at the end of this year and like starting an important – the way Boone said, he was like, yeah, he started a big spring training game for us. I was like, a big spring training game? What? Like, wait, for what? The Grapefruit League title? Like, and so for it to go from big spring training game to looms large in a game four is just great. Before we move on to Tigers guards, my one thing for this series is Aaron Judge. I believe he ended up with, what, 4 hits in this series? They were all singles. He took some pretty bad at-bats. One late in game 2 where he got a cookie from Garrett Whitlock when the score was still tied on a first pitch, just a hanging slider in the middle of the strike zone, and he just dribbled it foul. It was the type of pitch that Judge hits out a lot. Chris Kirschner at The Athletic had a good story about Judge heading into October, where as much as you can statistically prove that a player changes their approach in October, he does. He chases more. If you look at like the timing of his swing, he's out in front more. He seems a little bit antsier. Again, if the Yankees win the World Series, it's Aaron Judge won a World Series. And if the Yankees don't, it's Aaron Judge still needs a ring. And so he did not. He looked fine in this series. But if the Yankees are going to make a deep run and knock off the Blue Jays, they need him to hit some home runs. Jordan Schusterman, who you got in this series?
I'll go with the Yankees. But I don't know, man. I think Toronto's just kind of got that. They got that buzz right now. Now, again, you got to go prove it, as we just laid out. They have not proven a whole lot in October recently. But this is the fact that they got home field here feels significant. And I'm very, very curious. And the last thing I mentioned about Schlittler, the Red Sox hadn't faced them. I know they faced them against Northeastern. They did not face Schlittler in the regular season. The Jays faced him twice. He had pitched pretty well. It was his second career start, was in Toronto. And then his worst start of the season, he only lasted like an inning and 2/3. It seemed like he realized he was tipping his pitches, and that's why he got crushed. But the Jays have a little bit more familiarity with him, so that could play a role to some degree. But I'm going to go with the Yankees. I am going to go in 5, and that is somewhat manifesting because I think I would be the one to go cover that. So we will see if that actually happens. But I'm going to go Yankees in 5.
Great. I will do Yankees in 5 as well. Let's move on from Yankees Jays and quickly recap Guardians Tigers. You were at game 1 and 2 of this, but I'm going to fly through it just so we don't get hung up on it. Game 1, Tarik Skubal dominates. Unreal. Just great performance. 14 Ks, 72/3. You have Gavin Williams is great. But it's like this is why you have Tarik Skubal. He had like these moments where he somehow allowed runs to the Guardians down the stretch. That happens again. The Guardians score a run in the most Guardians way, which is an infield chopper and the runner scoring from second base. They get Jose Ramirez to third in the 9th with nobody on. They cannot score him, and bulletproof Will Vest locks it down. Tigers win 2-1. Game 2, that one is also tied until late. Guardians have a 5-run 8th inning. George Valera hits a solo shot, couple of base knocks before a Bo Naylor 3-run homer. They win 6-1, and that set up the Yom Kippur afternoon game 3 for the second consecutive season. A winner-take-all game between these two clubs on Yom Kippur.
Indeed, and that is why I was not in the building on Thursday, but I did not seem to miss too memorable of a game as the Guardians' magic finally runs out. Dylan Dingler opens the scoring for Detroit late. They add 4 more runs in the 7th, And the kind of offensive explosion that the Guardians had late in game two, the Tigers find that in game three when they need it. Both of these teams, we knew offensively challenged. I mean, certainly Cleveland more than Detroit. But Detroit's hitting with runners in scoring position in game two was brutal. I mean, this was a one for really, 15. Really tough. Yeah, 1 for 15, which, you know, you can say, I think, like, when you're talking, managers get asked this all the time, what's your problem hitting with runners in scoring position? And over the course of a long season, that's, you know, fluky. But when you're watching it in the moment in these big games, it is so tough to watch. And the Tigers just could not get anything going in game two. Credit to the Guardians pitching, which has, of course, been great for a while now. But they managed to get the runs they need. And Cleveland just kind of runs out of gas. And there's a little bit more chaos in the eighth inning where Jose Ramirez, once again, there's some weird stuff happening. Will Vez drops a ball and the ball caroms away. He picks it up, throws him out at first, or throws Ramirez out at second, trying to advance. I would say with a great tag from Javi Baez, who had an awesome series, that's definitely something to keep an eye on. But listen, as Kerry Carpenter said in the celebration afterwards, you know, we hear a lot about the 15 and a half games that they were up in July, but we're going to Seattle and they're not. That's from Kerry Carpenter. Now, here's the thing, Kerry Carpenter. You're still not great to, like, remind everyone that you blew a 15 and a half game lead.
Doesn't matter.
But hey, now
the thing, though, Jordan,
it is very. Look, it is.
Is yeah. Blowing a 15 and a half game lead embarrassing? Duh. Is building a 15 and a half game lead the reason why they were able to blow it in the first place? Yes.
Bingo. Yes.
It is hard to remember this now, but the Tigers had the best record at the All-Star game. Right.
Yeah.
Now, I think they were playing above their skis and this team is not that good, but they're also not as bad as the team that blew that lead. And now that snowballing has stopped, the Tigers now fall somewhere in the middle between those two extremes.
Yes. Yes. And but because of how it's gone and because they had to go on the road and beat the team that's been kicking their ass for the last 6 weeks in Cleveland. Now they are starting to be like the nobody believes in us team, which is whatever. I mean, that's what you would expect for a team in this position. And as we move to this preview against the Mariners, I think on paper, a fitting description from a talent discrepancy standpoint. But before we get to that quickly, we do need to say goodbye to the Guardians of Cleveland.
Wow.
Who I have watched. I mean, this has been an amazing thing to witness up close over the last few months. This was one of the more ridiculous seasons that a team has ever had. And you got to give credit to the people that were able to do their jobs well enough to put them in position. That is the coaching staff. That is the pitching staff. That is, you know, I would say the front office in terms of being aggressive to be able to bring up a George Valera to say, screw it, we're putting Chase DeLauder on the roster. I think they recognized, they understood their own limitations, and they did whatever they could to overcome them. It is still a reflection of a disappointing position that in some ways they put themselves in terms of the roster that they came into the season with. But you have to give credit to the people around the team to get over what they did, not just the 15 and a half game lead, sure. All the things that were hampering themselves beyond how, you know, what was going on with the Tigers. Of course, it took a Detroit collapse to even get to that point. But they won, I think, 17 of their last 20 games in the regular season. And they could have rolled over after getting dominated by Skubal in game two and in game one, and they didn't in game two. And it was a very memorable season. And there's some things to be excited about moving forward. Of course, the pitching, the Gavin Williams breakout. There are some young bats coming, whether it's Bizana, we're going to have DeLauder, you know, maybe Valera becomes an everyday guy. But whatever. I mean, this was, as we know, objectively one of, if not the worst offense to ever arrive in the postseason. And that they need to fix to some degree if they are going to be taken seriously going into next year.
It is better to be sad on October 3rd than it is to be sad on September 29th. And I think this Guardian season will live on for a long time. And I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Like, obviously, it's good that they did this in this way.
Yeah.
But my concern here is this. Something needs to change with how they acquire, identify, and develop offense. Okay?
Correct.
Now, that includes hitting, and is a lot about hitting, mostly hitting. They are too good at the other stuff, defense, pitching development, base running, finding stuff on the margins, for them to be this offensively offensive every freaking season. Because the reason the Guardians did not win more games during the regular season and did not advance in the playoffs is very simple. They did not have enough good impact hitters. Simple as. They did not. Now, if you were to talk to like Chris Antonetti, the Pobo, about this, he'd be like, you know, we really like what we're seeing from Valera, and we think, you know, Bo Naylor can take a step forward. Enough. It's like every year, right? Go out and add a real bat, which they won't. Okay. Like, prove to me that you can develop hitters, because they have not really successfully onboarded a guy into being an impact bat at the big league level since Stephen Kwan.
Yeah, no, that's accurate. And that's why DeLauder and Bizzano, because they are close to the big leagues, it is important. And we will see how it goes. And then the last thing to say is, like, we're going to get the conclusion of the Emmanuel Clase and Luis Ortiz investigation at some point over the next few months. But for now, you can almost certainly enjoy watching them in the Dominican Winter League, where they are working out and preparing for the season with the Estrellas. I fully expect them to be anchoring that pitching staff after being unable to participate in the 2025 Major League Baseball season.
Will they play in the Dominican Winter League? You can bet on it, and you probably can bet on it. It is so funny that they're on the same team, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, Ortiz. I think Estrellas acquired Ortiz before he even got popped here, so that's just a nice circumstance there. Anyway,
can you imagine,
that, we will continue, like, we'll talk about that whenever we get it, because that is a thing. One of the stories of the offseason, if we still don't know by then, is like, what's going on here?
How's this going to go? So, could you imagine, like, I imagine when dudes show up to winter ball, everyone's always like, how was your year? Like, how'd your season go? Clase and Ortiz, like, Clase is like, you know, I took a little bit of a step back on the mound, and it was fine.
All right. Tigers, Mariners. This is also the first time these two teams are playing in the postseason. That is less surprising than Yankees, Blue Jays, for obvious reasons, because these two teams have not been in the playoffs that often. But this is indisputably the least compelling from a national buzz standpoint of the four division series. However,
you think?
I'm excited for this. I'm obviously going to be locked in for this one. I will be in Detroit for games 3 and 4 if necessary. The Mariners won the season series this year 4-2. They played in the second series of the year. The Tigers, who had come after getting swept by the Dodgers in LA, went up to Seattle and won that series. And then, quite memorably, the last series of the first half, the Mariners went into Detroit and put up 35 runs in 3 games and swept the Tigers. And it was like, okay, Mariners are turning it on. And that was kind of the beginning of like, uh-oh, Tigers, uh-oh. And the Mariners really started to heat up. So they really went in different directions after that point. The other thing to know about this matchup is that the Mariners are the only team to beat Tarek Skubal twice this season. Skubal allowed 3 runs against him in April, 4 runs against him in July. Now, that might not be good news for the Mariners, because the version that I just watched of Tarek Skubal the other day was one of the most dominant and ridiculous pitching performances I've ever seen. The Mariners lineup is a lot better than what the Guardians rolled out there on Tuesday, and so that should certainly give them a better chance. However, Tarek Skubal, that version of him was going to be dominating against basically anybody. So if he can channel that again and bring out that version of him, anything close to that version of him in game 2, it's, you know, they got a shot. But as I mentioned earlier, the Tigers hitting with runners in scoring position and just in general of the second half has just been so inconsistent. So few hitters that you're really banking on. And the reality of this matchup is that the Mariners are just way better on paper. And this is a situation where the big thing I'm thinking about them is, they are the number one team that is going to be, if they even don't score for the first 3 innings on Saturday against whatever Tigers bullpen game they conjure up, you're going to start hearing, oh boy, they were rusty. They didn't know how to deal with the layoff. They're dealing with a worse team, and they're nervous. They haven't scored a postseason run at home in 25 years. This is the team that is going to be like, are they feeling it? Whereas the Tigers are feeling good now. On paper, the Mariners should be able to handle the Detroit Tigers. That is a fact. But they got to do it, because the Tigers, yeah, they're feeling good now. And so I can't, gritty I again. Certainly can't say it is a lock. But I think for the Mariners to not, they have to win this series for this season to not be a massive disappointment. You know, what happens next round against the Toronto and the Yankees? You could say, oh, the Mariners are the team to beat in the AL. They have to get the World Series. I'm not going to go that far. They have to win this series. They really, really, really do for this to feel like a meaningful step forward for the organization.
And I really think they need to take both of the games in Seattle. When they go back to Detroit, think about how the vibe is going to be in Detroit, right? The last time that the Tigers were at home, I believe they finished the season with that series in Cleveland and then going to Boston.
Yep. And is then back to Cleveland. Yep. So, yep.
And then they've been back on the road to Cleveland. For 2 weeks. So this team has been in Detroit for a long time. It reminds me of the way that the 2022 Phillies, I believe they finished the year with a 10-game roadie and then won the wild card series in St. Louis. I was at that final Philly series of the regular season, and there was no one there because they were like, this team is just going to flame out. And then I was at the first home game in game three of the DS, and it was a party. I would expect something. I mean, there's nothing like a, you know, Philly fans. I would expect something similar in game three. Like the energy, if the Tigers can take one of the two in Seattle, the energy for game three in Detroit is going to be awesome.
100%, and I'm so excited to be there for that. And I love that comp of 2022 because not only, I mean, it was a little bit different because of where the Phillies were. The Tigers finished their season on an L7 at home. They lost five straight series at home to end the season, lost a series at home against the Mets, series at home against the White Sox, swept by the Guardians, swept by the Braves. That's how they finished their home slate. Now they get to come home for postseason baseball. And this is, as I mentioned about the same theme with the Mariners, like, this is the ultimate, like, if you can steal game one situation because you can give Scooble the ball in game two. And the last super important point before we take a break here is Brian Wu. This dude who left his start on September 19th with a pec injury. They said it wasn't serious. They weren't going to put him on the IL. He threw a bullpen yesterday. It certainly doesn't seem like he's going to be available for the first couple games of the series, which is not good, but okay. You still got Logan Gilbert. You got Castillo. You got Kirby. You got good options. But man, oh man, like if Brian Wu's not even available for a game three or for a game four, not until a game five, if it even gets that far, that is concerning because he has been their best pitcher all season. And that is not what you want at this time of year is to be managing an injury like that in any sort of way. So that is ominous a little bit. But even with that, the talent gap here on both sides of the ball is substantial, and the Mariners should take advantage.
By the time we have the Tigers playing a home game in this series, I believe it will be October 8th. It will be over a month. October 7th, I think. It will have been over a month since they won a game at home. Their last W at home was on September 6th against the White Sox. Okay, so like feels unique for sure. All right, let's take a break. Yes. That was the AL. Went a little long, but this is
Mariners
the time
in
to
four.
Do it. You're holding
Mariners in four. What you got?
Mariners in three.
All righty. We'll see how that goes. All right, I'll be there in Detroit to cover those games. Let's take a break, Jake. And when we return, oh boy, it's the National League. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. Time to talk about the National League games that we barely watched relatively because we were covering the American League games and feeling very hungry on our couch during Yom Kippur. We will begin in Los Angeles where the Dodgers effectively got a bye. Their scrimmage against the Cincinnati Reds panned out very well for them. A great tweet from our friends over at Tipping Pitches. Recency bias, sure, but it does feel awfully silly that we changed the playoff format so the 84-win Reds could charter a flight to LA to throw the Dodgers batting practice. That is exactly what it felt like. Now, we did learn some things about the Dodgers, particularly the bullpen, in this series, but the Los Angeles offense was like, hey, we're awake now. They obliterate the Reds pitching staff in both of these games. They scored 10 runs in the first game, 8 runs in the second game, and just they they kicked their butt, dude. I am so disappointed in the Reds. I had such high hopes for them all season long. And I truly cannot believe that this team underwhelmed so thoroughly in October. Actually, wait, I can't. Even though I picked them.
Yeah.
I'm mad that I picked them now. I wanted to. It was an olive branch. They took the olive branch and they snapped it in half.
I could tell. Yeah. I think it was pretty apparent if you were listening to that Jake's pick of the Reds was not exactly really fully spirited. That said, yeah, I mean, this was domination. And, you know, the contrast too of the other three series going three games does not help the perception of the Reds' effort here. We knew that game two, it's like, how are they going to do this? Whether they started Nick Lodolo or not, it was all going to be about whether Hunter Green could actually make the Dodgers sweat, and he couldn't. Whether he was tipping pitches or not, there's some discourse, oh, maybe the Dodgers knew what every Reds pitcher was throwing in the first game. It's not good enough. The Dodgers hit 5 homers in the first game, 13 hits with 0 homers in the second game. And Snell and Yamamoto were awesome. And that's really why the Reds didn't have much of a shot here. Sure, they had some late rallies against the bullpen and you know, maybe some openings. But as with Cleveland, this was just not an offense to believe in that was going to be having any sort of chance at a long run. Their only chance was to keep it close with their good pitchers and make the Dodgers sweat. And it just didn't happen. I mean, Ohtani homered on the second pitch of the game or whatever. So in game one. So just a reminder of Ohtani's brilliance. The 2 homers he hit were jaw dropping in game one, and he didn't even have to pitch. So he's now lined up for game one against the Phillies. But for Snell to look great, the game one was tough because Snell looked awesome. You feel good about that. You still needed 4 pitchers to get the last 6 outs. That's, come on now. Like, these are the kind of things that as we look forward with the Dodgers, it's like, can you really survive this over and over? Roki looked good in game two. They have to feel good about that. And for the Reds, before we move to Dodgers Phillies, because that's what we're much more excited about, it sucks. It sucks that this went as many people expected. It was disappointing they couldn't put up more of a fight. I think that there are reasons to be optimistic about this roster from the pitching side, whether it is a Green, whether it is a Chase Burns. They have some more prospects coming. You hope Ellie continues to improve. But like Cleveland, whether our payroll is embarrassing or not, you got to find ways to score runs. And this lineup was nowhere near good enough to be in the same league as we saw as the Dodgers, and that was disappointing. The Reds now have an L8 in October, which is the second longest active streak behind your Baltimore Orioles, and they still have not won a playoff series in 30 years.
Jordan, they have not won a playoff series since the last time they won a playoff series, I was 31 days old. October 6th, 1995, rookie Hideo Nomo lost that game for the Dodgers. The Reds are so frustrating. I saw a really unfortunate tweet from a Reds fan on Twitter that was like, for those of you that are new here, no, they will not go get the big bat they need this October or this offseason. And that is sad. Let's preview what is just a scintillating prospect. The Los Angeles Dodgers against the Philadelphia Phillies in the NLDS. 2 Titans going toe-to-toe. I will be there for games 1 and 2 in Philadelphia. Oh, this is great. Now, one of these 2 teams has been in every NLCS since 2020. Okay. Dodgers were there in 2020, 2021, Phillies in 22 and 23, Dodgers last year. Now one of them will be there again. And yet during that stretch, they have not played in October, which is fascinating because these have been, of this decade, the 2 NL teams, right? They have dominated the National League this decade, and they have not faced off. The Braves probably belong in that conversation too, but they have not faced off in the playoffs. And here they will in 5 games. During the 6 games, they played each other in the regular season. I believe one of the series was like the second week of the year here. In Philly. And then the other one was very recent towards the end of the season with the Phillies going out to LA. There's so much to talk about with this one. Game one will be Shohei Ohtani against Christopher Sanchez. It's going to be unbelievable. Then there's the off day on the NL side so that the series can get off cycle with one another. That will impact the pitching, the starting pitching, certainly. And then it's Snell against probably Jesus Luzardo. And then another off day, Yamamoto versus Ranger Suarez out in LA. Then maybe Glasnow, maybe Kershaw. I think it'll be Glasnow versus Aaron Nola or Walker Buehler or Sanchez in short rest. This is the series. This is the NLDS series that will be a big freaking deal. Where do you want to start in previewing this one?
I am just ecstatic about these pitching matchups. Of course, we wish that Zach Wheeler was a part of this too, and this is where that is really felt. But the Phillies obviously still have an awesome chance because they are able to roll out Christopher Sanchez and Luzardo and Ranger Suarez. But I think that's something I'm thinking about too, right? To have those three lefties and how those guys match up against the Dodgers, I think that that's a good thing. I think that that is an optimistic interpretation of how this can go for the Phillies, but it is still a difference to not have Zach Wheeler. The fact that the with that off day that the Dodgers could in theory throw Ohtani twice because game one and game five are a full week apart. But man, oh man, I mean, this is I think really what I'm thinking about is the Dodgers, even in these two games, but for much of the season too, the offensive firepower has been on display, right? We know Mookie hasn't had the same season, whatever. The Phillies, the names are in the lineup, but it hasn't necessarily always been a cohesive attack. It's been Schwarber's been the most consistent, but Harper has not always been producing it this season. But we know what Harper's and then Turner, of course, with the injury. On paper, these two lineups should be able to match up with each other and just slug like crazy. But we've seen the Dodgers do it more consistently, especially in the postseason. And so that's where, even though I picked the Phillies to win the World Series, and I'm still going to pick them at the end of this segment, I do feel like the Dodgers are, as we said earlier this week, looking way better on paper now than they did a year ago, and that is a scary thought.
So the three lefties is very interesting. The Dodgers are fine against lefties over the last 2 months, which is really the roster they'll enter with. They're like 10th in a lot of these categories against left-handed starters. You get kind of an Ohtani bump down. You get not really any of a Freeman bump down. He is just as good against left-handed pitching. You get a small Muncy bump down. And then, you know, Teo, bizarrely, has been horrendous against lefties now for a couple of months, even though he's a right-handed batter.
Had no idea.
426 OPS against left-handed pitching since August 1st. Excuse me, since July 1st for Teo. 426, I'm going to say that again. 426 OPS for right-handed hitting Teoscar Hernandez against left-handed pitching since July 1st. How will he do against the left-handed starters for the Phillies? Could be a huge part of this series. But really, dude, I mean, it's Ohtani in game one making his first career playoff start and leading off, right? He is going to lead off the game.
Pretty cool.
Against Christopher Sanchez. And then he is going to throw the first pitch. Like, we have never seen anything like this in the playoffs. It will be very – we get a new Ohtani thing seemingly every year, and this will be this year's new Ohtani thing.
Yeah. No, it is really that simple. That is a fascinating note about Teo. I'm chalking that up to small sample because he's been destroying lefties for 10 years. I could totally see him taking one of these guys' yard. But it is an interesting trend to monitor. But no, Ohtani is the story, as he deserves to be. Whether he would have to start twice is really interesting. What both teams do on the mound in a game four is also something I'm very intrigued about, especially since we assume it's unlikely this series is going to be a sweep in either direction. So we will see, like the prospect of Buehler pitching against the Dodgers. That is very fun. Does Nola even get the ball at all? We will see how this goes. I'm going to pick the Phillies in five, but...
Me too.
I don't know, man. The Dodgers are so good. This is good. It's like we finally got here where we're like, yeah.
I think the off day helps the Phillies more, because they have like three relievers, four relievers that I trust. And so being able to run them back with a day of rest, whereas the Dodgers, I guess they have Roky. Like, I don't trust anybody.
It's not about the rest because we don't trust any of them. Yeah. Yeah. That's fair. That's a big part of it too, right?
So like,
I feel way better about Duran and those guys instead of anyone the Dodgers are rolling out there. I agree.
if the Reds got to the Dodgers bullpen, I think the Phillies might have a chance. Let's do the final series of the wild card round. Padres Cubs fly through this one. Game one, Cubs win 3-1. Pivetta is fine. Seiya Suzuki, Carson Kelly hit back-to-back homers. But the story for them is the bullpen. Palencia, Pomerantz, Kittredge, Keller, perfect for 4 2/3 after Matt Boyd starts it. Michael Boyd, whose teammate Matthew Bush played first base. The Cubs win 3-1. Game two, the Andrew Kittredge opener for Imanaga doesn't work great. I would say Imanaga left out there a little too long. He has given up. He can give him up. He is on the list of guys who can absolutely give him up. He gave up a big Machado two-run shot here. Padres pitching, and this one was the story. Mason Miller strikes out every batter he faces. That's not true, Jordan. He hit someone at the end of game two. Oh,
sorry.
First eight. The greatest pitch in baseball history, maybe 104 on the black, down and away. That was unreal. Padres win 3-0. Cubs offense can't do anything. Game three, this is Yu Darvish goes one inning. Padres bullpen mostly, you know, shows up, but the bats do not. They enter the ninth inning with the Cubs up 3-0. Horrible call from home plate umpire DJ Rayburn on Xander Bogaerts after Jackson Merrill leads the inning off with a solo home run. And then they, you know, get some base runners on. Kittredge comes in and closes it out, and the Cubs win 3-1. Let's just do umpire discourse very quickly. Look, bad call, horrible call. Not the reason the Padres lost. Not even remotely close. In the end, this offense was not good enough. They did not score a run for 8 innings of the series. They end the series with just 5 runs to their name across 3 games. That's not good enough. And I think that was the theme of this Padres season, is that the offense thoroughly underwhelmed. They finished 3rd to last in home runs with all these huge names on the roster. And that is how their season ends. Like, should Padres fans be frustrated that the ump blew that call? Absolutely. Like, that sucks. And I'm excited to have ABS. This team was not good enough to win the World Series. This was not like, oh man, if only not for that blown call, we would have a parade in the gas lamp. Like, let's be real. That's not the case. And the Padres bench snapping at the umpires after this was some juvenile, entitled baby crap. Like, be better than this. Like, come on now. Like, yeah, bad call. There are always bad calls. They happen.
I will push back a little bit. I think that it is more plausible that this team could have won than Boston. But I mostly agree that that's clearly not the reason that you lost. But yeah, it just sucks. When you did assemble a bullpen that was absolutely World Series caliber and in theory, the talent and the rotation to do enough. But you weren't scoring runs. And the names, it sucks that Merrill was finally heating up now and then the other guys were going cold. It's a really, really disappointing showing. And once again, AJ Preller will be a main character this offseason with Cease and Arise hitting free agency. And the thing about the call is, like, listen, we all say, oh, well, ABS would have fixed that. Who's to say they would have had a challenge left at that point in the game? And that's part of what's going to be really interesting about this. There are going to be very similar situations where you realize, like, oh, if only I could challenge that, but I challenged that even worse call in the sixth inning and got it wrong. So it's not an automatic fix. So just keep that in mind as we move forward. I know you're mad, but that is not the reason your season is over. Jake Mintz, let's return to the Midwest. Sorry, San Diego. I am a little bummed that now we have eliminated the possibility of going to San Diego for the World Series. But you know what? I would be thrilled to go to Jordan, Chicago or Milwaukee.
Yeah. San Diego's a great city. Love it there. Milwaukee, most underrated city in America. I have never covered a game there. I am just ecstatic about that possibility. Cubs Brewers won't be in any of those games. That's the Russ Dorsey special.
It sure is.
Boy, oh boy, this is going to hit. Dude, this series is going to be sweet. These two teams have never played in the postseason. Okay, a reminder that they have both been bad for much of their histories. Now, they did play that one game 163 in 2018, I believe. Mm-hmm. But game 163 is out the postseason. And this is going to rip so freaking hard. This is actually the series I'm the most excited to watch. And I am look, I'm not going to come on a podcast and be like, dang, I can't watch Cubs Brewers because I have to be at Phillies Dodgers. My life sucks. That's not the case. But I am excited to watch these highlights back once I get back to my hotel room after these games. Pitching matchups. A lot of Tom Brady's dad in this one. If you are new here, when we see TBD on the projected pitcher list, that is Tom Brady's dad getting the ball. Freddy Peralta will be getting the ball in game one for the Brewers against Tom Brady's father for the Cubs. Then an off day, which is important for the Cubs because, boy, oh, boy, they need to rest these arms. Probably Priester versus Boyd in game two, another off day. I think the Brewers will do like a two innings for everybody type deal. Chad Patrick, Jacob Mizorowski, Robert Gasser. Whoever starts that game is not going to go particularly deep. Maybe we see Quintana for the beginning as well. And then the big X factor here is Cade Horton, right? Cade Horton, who is one of the best pitchers in baseball over the second half for the Cubs, going to finish top three in Rookie of the Year. He like fractured a rib in the last week of the season. It's unclear how. Is he available? I don't think so. Fascinated to see what kind of role he plays.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, again, we love the Brewers, and as you said, love for them to go make us go to Milwaukee later this month. But it's like, and yes, injuries have contributed to this, but when you have the team with a top seed who like barely knows who's pitching in game three after getting a bye, it's just like, ah. You know, I know it's worked, but it's like that's not the situation that you want to be in. But the reality is, against a team like the Cubs, who's also stretched pretty thin, it's not by any means like, oh, no, they're screwed, because they've managed to figure this out. But
Blue Jays have the same thing. And I feel less good about their options. Also.
Yeah, I was going to say Toronto is the same thing. And you could say some of that is injuries. You could say some of that is, you know, Barrios hurt, Bassett hurt, Scherzer is like a total wild card. Although it feels like Scherzer is going to get a postseason start. Like, whether that's a good or a bad idea, like, you can sneer all you want, but I feel like if Max Scherzer is on the roster, no matter how many runs he's given up the last few times, I think they're going to let him start. So, we'll see about that anyway. But for Milwaukee, it's the opposite. You have all these rookies that you could kind of mix and match with.
Sure. Trevor McGill, who was one of the best closers in baseball all season long, got hurt in late August. Went on the IL, I believe it was like August 26th, 27th-ish. Mm-hmm. Came back, made one relief appearance on the final day of the regular season. Struck out two guys and threw one inning. That was, I believe, in the fourth inning of that game. What role does he play in the series? That off day could be important because they would probably feel more comfortable with his efficacy with an off day in between, not throwing him on a back-to-back. McGill feels important to me in this one. I am going to take the Brewers in four. I think they get it done. Does the bit work in October? Who in the world knows? I think that Wrigley is a tough place to drive the baseball when it's cold, right? And the narrative that home runs don't win in October is stupid because they do. All the data shows that. In an environment where it's hard to hit home runs, would you rather be the team that doesn't rely on it, or would you rather be the team that can hit it through the wind? Someone get Petriello on the horn. Someone smarter than us. Still, I'm going to take the Brewers' magic in this series.
I think I picked the Brewers in our official picks, but I don't know, man. I
pivot,
feel
baby.
Like the Cubs. Feel like the Cubs are kind of going to start cooking here, but we'll see. We will see how this goes, and yeah, I'm with you. And this is the first one. This will start on Saturday, 2 p.m., first pitch from Mr. Freddy Peralta. Very much looking forward to that. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to talk about some non-postseason teams for a few minutes before we bid you a good weekend. We'll be right back on Baseball Podcast. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. There were 12 teams in the playoffs, and it felt like 18 teams firing their managers. Let's go around the league. We will begin not in the dugout, but in the quarter zip aisle of your nearest State and Liberty. That's probably what GMs wear. No free ads. And Paul, we have two new Pobos being introduced this week. Paul Toboney for the Washington Nationals, who we will henceforth be referring to as Poboney. Just an absolute layup. Hoping that the Giants play the Nats in the NLCS next year so we can have Buster Posey against Paul Poboney. A thing that is only funny to the two of us and maybe two of you. Poboney, who I will call him that to his face, I'm sure, by accident, introduced as the Pobo for the Nationals, was with the Red Sox for a long time, I believe over 10 years, kind of ran a lot of their player development stuff. His comments during the introductory press conference were very interesting. The Red Sox have developed a reputation, particularly on the hitting side, for being active about fostering competition in development. I think Poboney said something along the lines of, we like to practice with a scoreboard. We like winners and losers and how we train. And I think that is a good thing that for the Washington Nationals. I like this hire, not knowing much about the guy. He presents well, great. It is the background of player development. I think that is the area where the Nationals have fallen the most short in the Mike Rizzo era. Yes, there have been other problems with this team, but bringing in a guy who's an expert at PD, like that to me is a huge deal.
Yep, totally agree. Him saying we want to create a scouting and player development monster is exactly what they should be getting at. And I want to bring in the other introduction here, which is Chaim Bloom being introduced as the Cardinals' new Pobo, as a really interesting contrast for the jobs that those two guys are taking on and how they've gone about arriving at those positions. Because I think what Toboney spoke about is he said all the right things, but we know for a fact that it is going to take time for him, not only from where the roster is to turn into a winner, but to understand where the Nationals are behind and what needs to be changed, that is going to be a process for sure. That is probably going to take more than 1 year. Whereas for Chaim Bloom in St. Louis, now the Cardinals, as we have dubbed them, the most forgettable team, arguably 2 years in a row, Bloom has been there for the past year. And Bloom has seen already what the Cardinals are not doing well. And so he kind of got that. Now, while the arrangement over the past year was admittedly strange, clearly there was some odd dynamics involved with John Mozeliak kind of slowly being moved to his side while also still running the show. Maybe that was problematic for the Cardinals over the last couple of years. That's fine. But Bloom clearly already understands, and we know this talking to people around this organization, that he understands what needs to happen. And so it is much more plausible that the Cardinals could get back on track faster. Now, that said, what Bloom spoke about in his press conference was being very clear about viewing this as a long-term situation, saying that we are going to have to make hard decisions that might not be, you know, obvious as like we're going to have the Cardinals win in 2026. So there could be some real shakeup coming up. But Bloom, considering his experience already doing this job and the fact that he's already been there for the past year, kind of observing and understanding where the Cardinals have fallen short, I think that's interesting to think about for both of these guys as they try and get these organizations going in the right direction.
Sure. I think that this setup has been weird in St. Louis, but now it's a good thing for Chaim Bloom. He basically got like a free year of having no expectations or pressure on his shoulders where he could evaluate the organization. So he's day one in the chair. He has a thorough understanding of what the problems are and has already started going about organizing how to fix those problems. My understanding is that Chaim was more involved over the past year on the player development and scouting side and less like at the big league level. And I would expect that to be where we see changes. They hired a new guy to run their pitching dev last year, Matt Pierpont, who was a big dude over in Seattle. And so that is a hire that a lot of people like. I'm excited to see what Chaim does. Obviously, a friend of the program. Looking at Paul Toboni, his career, I don't know if he faced current Washington National Trevor Williams in college, but I know that current Washington National Trevor Williams pitched against Paul Toboni's Cal Bears while Trevor was at Arizona State. So
irrelevant. This is the main point about Toboni is that he's 35, right? So we've had some young, both managers, but certainly GMs and high level front office guys. But this is certainly a new standard for that for Paul Toboni. And I think he's like a year older than Trevor. So I don't think there's anyone on the active roster projected for next year that is older than Toboni, but it's very plausible that they could add a veteran that is. And so that would be an interesting dynamic. And that is also a good transition to our final topic.
Just quickly.
Anything else on Toboni before we get to the manager?
Yeah, I mean, Toboni, I believe, overlapped at Cal with Marcus Semien. So like, again, not exactly the oldest guy in the room. Okay, let's pivot to the managers. And we'll fly through these. I'm just going to say everything that happened because there was a flurry of stuff. It's weird, the timing of this. It's also understandable. And then we can kind of circle back on any of the interesting ones. Texas Rangers, Bruce Bochy. The wording here, I believe, is steps down. Understandable. He's 71, won the World Series. There was a lot of rumors the whole season this would be it for him. Is Skip Schumaker next? He was an assistant in the front office this year. It felt like they brought him in to kind of have him be the manager and wait. We will see. Twins, Rocco Baldelli, fired. Question there. Not really his fault. Will he get hired somewhere else? I'm going to lean yes, although I would not be surprised, no, because he has a couple young kids. Maybe he wants to take a year off if none of these jobs appeal to him. Angels firing two managers at the same time, Ron Washington and Ray Montgomery, who filled Wash's shoes this season when he was dealing with some health issues. This firing was not like Wash is not healthy enough to manage the team. This was, we do not think Wash is ready to manage the team or is the right guy anymore. This is going to be Albert Pujols. I feel pretty strongly about that. It feels like the type of, it reminds me of when they fired Brad Ausmus when he managed for 1 year because they knew Joe Maddon was going to be available, right? Where it's like, they're like, Wash is not bad, but if we could get Albert Pujols, like he's famous and an angel.
I mean, they're literally already paying Pujols, right? We've had some reporting that Artie Moreno is interested. Normally, we're looking at, okay, who does Perry Manassian going to hire? In this case, we're not worried about that because, one, we don't even know if Perry's going to be back, and two, we know Artie's calling the shots. They're already paying Albert as just like the he basically is just like
personal
part of the
organization. Contract.
Yeah, in 1 perpetuity, or not perpetuity, for I think at least 10 years since the end of his contract. And Albert wants to manage. We know that. So this would obviously be a humongous story if it actually happens. I'm not quite as certain, but based on the smoke so far, it certainly would not surprise me. So that would be a huge thing if Albert takes that job, because it is probably arguably one of the least attractive ones of the ones here.
The most attractive one on this list, in my opinion, by a mile, is the Atlanta Braves. Brian Snitker, heck of a run. Obviously a disappointing last season for him. But one of the most unique, impressive coaching careers we have ever seen. He has only ever worked for the Atlanta Braves.
Yeah, and he only ever will work for the Atlanta Braves. I'm sure he will remain in the org in some capacity. But he was a Braves lifer in the minors, and suddenly he was a big league manager, and he held it all the way through with the World Series and some of the best teams of the past 10 years. And obviously the talent on the field is a big part of that. But Snitker is indisputably a franchise icon at this point. And but as after the season, seems like it was time for him to move on. And as you mentioned, that is certainly a job that will come with the pressure of wanting to win now, especially after how bad this year went. But that's way more talent than you're going to get with any of these other jobs.
And the other thing about this one is because Snitker had been there so long, I think this is just going to be a whole new staff. Like this is going to be, this is going to look a lot different. A couple names just for this that come to mind for me is I think Shoemaker would be interested in this job as well. I think they should be interested in him. I think this a lot of these jobs, and we'll get to this with the Orioles, the job is going to probably be implementing the front office's ideology and going along with a plan. I don't think that is what Skip wants to do, right? I think Skip wants, as the top candidate on the market, Skip wants and deserves to have a little bit more juice than that. And I think that he can have that in Texas. Chris Young is a former player, I think, is going to be a guy that Skip would want to work with. But I think the Braves are a really strong fit for him. I'm curious if his name is in the mix. And then the funniest option would be another Snitker. Brian Snitker's son, Troy Snitker, is the hitting coach for the Houston Astros and somebody that has been mentioned as a future managerial candidate. So if, you know, this is like, you know, Don Jr. being president,
for a lot of reasons, I would be very shocked by that. I think it is going to be someone else, and whether Skip is considered on the market, if he works for Texas, I don't really know. Mark DeRosa, another one to watch. David Ross, another one to watch, who's trying to get back in. But we will see what's going on there. Are open.
Well,
yeah, oh my gosh.
Not for sure. The Giants is definitely open. Okay. Bob Melvin fired. That is like he's done, he's gone. The leader in the clubhouse here, based upon what I've heard, is probably Nick Hundley, who played with Posey, who I think is in the organization in some fashion. I would expect him.
He might also be with the Rangers.
I think you're right. Yeah. Is a candidate whose name I've heard a lot. There were some rumors about University of Tennessee coach Tony Vitello. Based upon what I've heard, that is just smoke. And that the two, like Posey and Vitello, were talking, I think, because they have a lot of Tennessee guys in the org. Like they drafted Gavin Keelan. They just acquired Blade Tidwell. Like, I don't think that Tony V is going to leave Knoxville to go manage the Giants. That doesn't feel right to me. This is a very interesting job, and I think the hire will tell us a lot about Buster Posey. I'm very interested to see where that one goes. Then we have three, the Rockies, Orioles, and Nationals, where like we don't know for sure we're getting a new manager, but we're almost certainly going to. The Nationals is a lock. Miguel Cairo, I don't even know if he's going to interview. Like Taboni's getting a whole new staff in there. That's a very interesting job. For the Orioles, I think Mancelino's probably out. I think that he deserves a job. Like, I think he's good. I wouldn't be shocked to see him interview for like the Twins job or the Nats job or the Giants job. Like, I think he'll be in the mix. Ryan Flaherty is a name to keep in mind for the Orioles, former Oriole. His dad was a Division III manager, head coach for a long time. He is, I think, the bench coach with the Cubs right now. How long they go for and survive in the playoffs may play a factor in his availability for that job. And then the last one is the Rockies. The Rockies have not fired interim manager Warren Schaefer, but they did, in big, big news, announce that Bill Schmidt, who has been the head man there for a long time, will be stepping down. Now, this is important. This is relevant that there's any level of change. And the Rockies already said they're going to hire outside the org for that role. The dude who has had a lot of juice there, kind of more than I think gets credit for, is Zach Rosenthal, who I think is the vice president of baseball operations. I'm interested to see if Rosenthal stays. If he stays, I have some level of skepticism that it's going to be a complete like overhaul. But if he goes, it means that I think the Rockies are serious business.
Yeah, if they actually hire someone else who would want to try and tackle that challenge, that would be really interesting. Just the last name I'll throw out there, and then we will wrap, is Craig Albernaz, the Guardians bench coach, who interviewed for the Marlins and White Sox before deciding to turn them down late last offseason to stick in Cleveland. I could see him being someone interviewing for some percentage of these jobs. And maybe we will get more. There's some smoke around the Astros. Incredibly, the Pirates are not changing anything. That's a conversation for another day. But I'm sure Pirates fans are like, oh my God, if everyone else is firing their guy, why are we sticking with these folks? But Don Kelly, one of the world's great Yinzers, I'm sure he's happy to still be in Pittsburgh. All right, that's it. We're done. We did a podcast. Sorry, no Good, Bad, Ugly this week. We'll bring it back in the offseason. Don't you worry, my friends. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Jake Mintz. Thank you to TJ Brassel, Andrew Hartz for producing. Enjoy the last day without baseball, hopefully for the rest of the month. We'll see how the schedule shakes out. But we appreciate, I guess we'll have those off days before the World Series, but appreciate you listening. Hopefully you enjoyed this episode. Everyone have a good weekend. Enjoy the division series. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.